Good afternoon, everybody. It's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Hans Mitkiewicz, who recently retired from the European University Institute in Florence, an institution that is a major centre of legal research and is very fortunately going to continue as part of the UK's forward relationships with Europe as a major place to go. And indeed, many students from here are now in Florence, enjoying themselves up on the hills, among the olive trees, and probably much warmer weather than we're getting. He's going to talk to us today about the European Union as a regulator of private law. He's a professor of economic law, but has many, many more areas to his bow, as you will discover. And he's offering us different paradigms of how to look at what the European Union does in relation to private law. So,
yes.
Great pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. Perhaps as an introduction to better understand the background of what I'm presenting. So at the EUI, for most of the time, most of the years that I spent there, I was very much focusing on to understand how the EU is transforming private law inside the EU for the member states. Yeah? So I was looking into all these sorts of regulation that the EU has adopted and how it affected the member states. Yeah, that was a big project. And last year I published a book here. It was Cambridge University Press. If you have nothing to do, then you can go through the 400 pages or so. Good. But during the years, and in particular because of an American colleague, Dennis Patterson, at the EUI, I started with him together seminars on what is the role of the EU in transnational law. Yeah. So what is? How can we catch the role? And what I'm presenting here is a research, ongoing research. So critical remarks are more than welcome. And it's the question, the overall question, how is the EU through private law affecting, so to say, the rest of the world? And John asked me that I should start with a case so that to better understand in the very common law tradition. I think I've learned enough at the EUI and at the time when I was in Oxford that you have to start with a case. So I will start with an American case to tell a European story. And it's a very famous case. You should know them, the case, I mean. It's the Kyogo case. It deals with the question of whether the US Supreme Court or the US has jurisdiction over the behavior of a company, a Dutch, British company, that has committed and infringed human rights, committed sincere human rights violations in Nigeria. That was the question. What the parties wanted the US Supreme Court to do was to enforce international law, international law rules. And as you know, the Supreme Court, in the end, rejected any responsibility. And when you look into the amicus curiae letters, then you will see that on the side of Shell, you have very strong positions taken by the Dutch and the UK government in order to argue that the US Supreme Court has no jurisdiction. The European Commission is diffuse, opaque. The letter is deliberately that they claim to be on neither side, which is not correct. What they are doing is they claim, if you can read here, that they more or less, the Commission is more or less encouraging the Supreme Court to accept universal jurisdiction for these kind of infringements, in particular, if there is no other way for the victims to go to court and to claim compensation. So that is the American scenario. There is no equivalent from the European Court of Justice. I cannot give you a case which comes even close to this. No. So the question that occupies me and where I'm seeking your feedback also is, how can we qualify and understand the role the EU is playing outside its own territory? And you may be familiar with the critique that has been raised in the last years against the EU, in particular also with regard to the role of the member states. And one of the protagonists of a very strong critique is a political scientist, Wolfgang Streeck, who is arguing that the EU has turned into a neoliberal, this is the catchword that I should not miss, into a neoliberal institution that is undermining national democracies and social rights and promoting free trade. Yeah. On the other hand, the counterpart is here for the discussion for you to have in mind in the broad picture. It's the famous book of Martti Koskoniemi, as I'm based in Finland now, that's a good way to refer to him. I think he is known far beyond Finland. And he wrote this book on the gentle civilizer of nations, having in mind the role and the rise and fall, as he puts it, on international law. So when we transfer this kind of discourse to private law, then the question is the EU contributing something to the debate, something that goes beyond maybe what Streeck is criticizing and what allows to have a more positive view on the European Union. One of famous article, I think, on looking at the EU from the outside and insisting on the positive role that the EU might play in the world is from Gronja de Berka, where she speaks about the raison d'être of the EU and that it has this kind of responsibility in a positive sense. So what is usually missing in this big scenario, and in particular in the law of external relations, I was sitting in the library and I briefly checked all the books on EU external relations law are in the library, everything what is known there, and it's nothing on private law. Yeah, so it's all about public law, security, whatever, trade law maybe to some extent, but it's not about contract law and all this. This is usually put into the box of international private law. I come back to this. But let us link this private law perspective. And when I speak of private law, I mean, I don't care about the difference between a codified law and a common law. I mean here contract law, contract tort law. And I mean, that is the basis of private law. So if you look into the missions of the EU, remember Joseph Weiler's wonderful article on the DNA of the EU. What is the mission? The original mission was, I think in our times, we should not forget this. The foundation, the ideological foundation of the Schuman Declaration was peace through trade. Yeah? Better we trade with each other than we kill each other. And that was important because if you look at all the documents, there's no private law. It was taken for granted that the private law, although it is the basis of trade, yeah, is in the hands of the member states and has no direct relationship to what the EU is doing. There is the story of direct effect and supremacy and how the ECJ, the Court of Justice, via the market freedom interferes into contract law. That is a story of itself. I leave this aside. Then the next step, the next mission, so to say, until today is the internal market and the Single European Act, which triggered a wave of regulation. Yeah. So after 1986, that was really the moment where the EU, via the possibility to take majority decisions in the Council, unleashed a huge range of regulation in whatever area of economic law, complementing the market freedoms, but also in what we could call social policies in a broader sense. That means, to some extent, limited extent in labor. I'm not a labor lawyer, I don't claim to be a labor lawyer, but I had a discussion and exchange with Mark Friedland, and he said maybe the English law is a bit better today because of the EU, a bit more social than it would have been without the EU. But there are some areas, if there are questions, we can go into it. A much more prominent area where the EU has left deep traces is non-discrimination law, because not only in gender, but then after some time beyond gender, and there is a set of directives that interfere by and large also into private and contract law relations. I forgot to mention here consumer law for sure. That was one of the big moves in the Single European Act. There is a famous report that I always encourage everybody to reread and to reread. That is the Sutherland report. And Sutherland, he built a wonderful argument that allowed the European Union to get into consumer law, because Sutherland argued the consumer is needed in order to implement the market. We need an active consumer shopping across border, comparing prices, making use of all the possibilities, traveling around the world, what we are all doing, in order to build the internal market. Another area where the European Union also got involved is environmental protection. And not least because of my country that constantly did not implement the respective directives, the European Court of Justice had many occasions to specify what it meant by the respective fields that are covering environmental law. This story goes on until today. There are shifts. One of the biggest shifts is the story of full harmonization, where the EU is trying to not only to set minimum standards in private law, but maximum standards. And the last year, for those who would like to go deeper, I think the last year, 2019, is amazing, because in the field of private law, if you understand it more broadly, you have 5, 6, 7 directives that were adopted, and most of them are aiming at full harmonization, means they are taking power away from the member states and shifting it to the EU. But please let us not forget that can only happen when there is a majority in the Council. So the member states are also playing here, as we know from political science, nested games. The last move, I would fix it to the year 2000. For me, the year 2000 in the history of EU law and EU private law is absolutely crucial. The Lisbon summit is only a political meeting of the heads of the state, and there is a declaration. It comes relatively close in length to the Schuman declaration, and there you have this bombastic language turning the EU into the most competitive economy of the world. And then a bit accomplished by rhetoric about social inclusion in order to make that fit. And the year 2000 is also the moment when this was bolstered in a way via the Declaration of on Fundamental Rights. That was the same year. And in 2002, not to forget the White Paper on Governments. If you take these three together and you bundle it and analyze it, that was the starting point, in my understanding, of where the EU really turned into a global player until today. Okay, when we talk about the role of the EU in the global world, so to say, and that is what is the purpose of my paper, then we should not forget the colonial history. When we are civilizing or using the language of the EU, civilizing companies, that might work. I think, John, I'm grateful for your proposal to change the title of my speech. I think that was an important shift, because we have to be clear and also to distinguish between who is the target of the EU policy. Is it the company or is it a country? Is the EU trying to civilizing the neighboring countries? For those of you who are in external relations, you know it. The EU has developed a very dense network of contracts out to manage its relationship to the outside world, and the neighboring countries are a particular target of this. But when we had this discussion in the 19th century, already in the colonial times, that the Western world is bringing civilization to the global south, as it is said together. So all what I want to say is, we are here on slippery ground when we connect the EU and giving the EU a civilizing role towards countries. That might be different when we look at companies, in particular when they are based in the EU, or as in Kyobel, when they are not based in the US, but are based, let's say, infringing internationally agreed rules. There is a kind of ideology that when you go into the colonial history and what you and you talk to the Commission and you talk to people who are working in external relations after 1960, more or less after the end of the colonial times in Europe, there is this conviction, this time we get it right. This time we do it better. We are not the nasty guys anymore that are exploiting all these countries. We in the EU, we want to be helpful to these countries. To what extent that is true is another matter. Now to private law. So when I talk about a private law, I think there is one difference that I learned in particular in interaction with my my colleagues from the from this part, from Britain. So Roger Brownsworth, with whom I was working a lot together, he always said to me, "Hans, but this is regulation. That's not contract law." So it's not regulation. And I remember you had in Cambridge and Oxford, you had a series of lectures or discussions a couple of years ago on what is the public and private law, or something like this. I remember. I couldn't participate, but I followed at least as far as possible. So the EU, and that is very important, you may know all these wonderful ideas of building a European civil code, all this failed, not least due to the resistance of the UK, of France, of Germany. All the big countries were against having such a European civil code, which would be in a way the basis or the substitute for what we have in the, or complement, depending on how you look at it, for what we have in the member states or in the nation states. So the EU is a regulator, and it regulates heavily. And my focus here is, please have this in mind, as I said in the beginning, I don't want to discuss what is the impact of what the EU is doing with the member states' regulations, but what is the EU doing with its own, what are the effects that the EU regulation is producing outside its own territory? When we start with international private law, so that is universal application. So that means whenever there is a connection to the territory of the EU, whenever you have, by and large, to simplify, you have two parties, one in the EU, the other one not in the EU, there is the possibility that the ECJ has jurisdiction, and there is the possibility that EU law applies under the Rome 1 and 2 regulation. It is an under-researched field to go through the cases of the ECJ, in particular in the Brussels regulation, and really to look into what is it, what the ECJ decided. Is there a difference whether it was an internal conflict or whether there was a party that was from the outside involved in that litigation? This is more or less true with regard to the other fields. So you have a lot of harmonized private law, particular consumer law, but also non-discrimination law. And usually you have some limited rules there on how these body of whatever rules on sales law or on doorstep selling or on distance selling or credit, in what way they are connected to the outside world. To some extent, the EU has tried to harmonize this and to integrate all this into the Rome 1 and Rome 2 regulation. But when you look deeper, it does not suffice. The more prominent field politically is what I call here the regulated markets. Yeah? That is a field where the EU, after 1986, interfered heavily in trying to liberalize these formerly state monopolies and also promote privatization. Yeah? And this is a field where you have a set of, I call them all silos. You have to go very deep into these sectors to understand how the EU in its particular mechanism is using regulation top down or in waves to interfere also in B2B and B2C contract rules. That is a burdensome exercise because you have to understand the language. Telecom has a language, energy has a language, finance anyway. But it's worth doing it. The last field is private ordering or private regulation, depending on which language you're using, where the EU is also heavily involved and where I will go deeper immediately. So the EU has two kinds of toolboxes, and the toolbox that is well known is you have regulations. They are immediately directly applicable, and over time the EU has adopted ever more regulations which do not need to be implemented into national law. And you have directives which, if you look into the history of EU lawmaking, have become ever longer and ever denser, and have they look more like regulations today in comparison to what they were some 20 years ago. What I find personally more fascinating is what I call the private law underground. Yeah. So, and that is a field where it's tricky because usually we understand that what the parties agree upon, or what is below what is the party agree upon, so technical standards, codes of conduct, all this, that becomes only part of the contract if the parties agree on it. Yeah? And then under some restrictions, it may be subject to some form of judicial control. It is a world where the EU has been particularly active and particularly successful. So the so-called new approach on technical standards is one of the success stories of the EU. It was meant to set aside so-called non-tariff barriers to trade. Yeah? So technical standards. I remember the stories from the 1970s in Europe, when the member states were defending all sorts of strange technical rules in order to prevent competitors from import. Yeah? So whatever, the light, the size and color of the light on tractors, or, you know, all funny, amazing rules that that led to distortions. But what you may perhaps not know is that this EU regulation, in particular one from 1973, the so-called low voltage directive, that was behind the TBT agreement under the GATT, and it was behind the WTO agreement and the SPS agreement on health and safety, and the connection between broad trade rules and standard making, yeah, Codex Alimentarius and all these institutions. So the EU was particularly successful in the promotion of these rules. And the key actors here are, I gave the abbreviations, these are French ones, but CEN, CENELEC and ETSI, these are different. CEN is for technical, CENELEC is for electrical, and ETSI is for telecom. They have a different design, but they are very prominent and they form part of this regulatory framework that the EU has set up and that the EU then transformed and developed and used extensively to build the banking union. What is important is, and why I call it the contractual underground, usually it is a rule setting. It is, in most of the times, legally not binding. It's all voluntary, but it's defining how the parties are interacting and very important, overall, deliberately, the EU is taking away the possibility to challenge technical standards before the European Court of Justice. I would go as far as to argue, but that would be a different lecture, that the technical standards or using standards, that is today the means of harmonization. It's no longer really so much directives and regulations, but in particular in our digital times and the economy and society, these forms of mechanism play an absolutely crucial role. So in the discussion on the so-called global reach, we have two prominent authors. One is my colleague now at the EUI, Joan Scott, and the other is Anu Bradford from Columbia University. And they are, in a way, they have introduced distinctions that we can use to discuss and to classify more deeply what is the EU doing, yeah? And if I put them all together, there's extraterritoriality, means when there is no connection, no territorial connection to the EU, usually in criminal law, yeah? So when there are infringements of human rights that can be sanctioned via criminal law, there is a particular ruling in the EU legal system. In most of the time, it's territorial extension, yeah? So the behavior of a company is sanctioned. And then we have the Brussels effect, where a whole company, where a whole country is over-complying with EU law in order to have access to the EU market. Yeah, that's Anu Bradford, where she showed that the US companies, for instance, are using product safety standards of the EU, not only to export their products to the EU, but also for the marketing within the US, because of the economies of scale. So if we translate this now, this threefold distinction, we have a relatively well and sophisticated picture of what the EU is doing and where we can identify a global reach. So you can, if you want, I can also leave the slides here. That's fine to me. But we can also, I can leave it for the discussion, because in a way that sums up what I am saying. So extraterritoriality, that is the classical Kyoto case, yeah? Because the Dutch company had no connection or a very loose connection. There was a subsidiary in the United States, but the home base of Shell, as you know, is not the United States. And that was the argument in the end that also the Supreme Court used So there is no connection, yeah? But the even the doctrinal discussion that you could trigger as an EU lawyer is to question to what extent is there, can we not argue that under European tort law, such an obligation to enforce international standards could be justified and should be even argued for de lege lata. Yeah? That's an interesting question. You have to pull the law in various directions, but there are interesting bits and pieces that nobody ever tried, not even NGOs. So I would be perhaps not optimistic in result, but at least I would see there an opportunity. When it comes to territorial extension, we have to I see here to make a distinction between who is the regulator. Yeah. So the focus in the discourse that Joan Scott had triggered, and Anu Breckford and Maurice Cremona and whoever is working, Jan Wouters and many more who are working in that field, is they focus on the ECJ. Yeah, they look at what is the ECJ doing, and then there are famous cases in competition law. There's a very famous West Tanker and Brussels regulation. In international private law, we have the Ingmar case. So lots of details to be discussed. What's interesting is when it comes to this regulatory private law, to in particular to the regulated markets where the EU plays such a prominent role, then you have to look at the Commission and you have to look at what the European agencies are doing, and these conflicts never go to court. Yeah, that means there is, you may argue this is part of the underworld, but it's an extremely practical world. And please do not forget, 70% of the gross income of Europe is services. Yeah, so the regulated markets are, for me, in my understanding, parts of that field and also in the statistics of the EU. So we are talking here about economically extremely relevant areas where it's not the ECJ that is monitoring the external conduct, the foreign conduct of companies, whether they are European outside Europe or whether they are non-European with an impact on Europe, but it is the European Commission and the European agencies. That means you have to go into empirical studies, you have to get access to this. Same with banking union, same with what the private regulators, in particular the standard bodies, are doing. But we can make a long list of other European associations and stewardship organizations that are trying to develop rules, codes of conducts in the field of CSR, for instance. So I could give a long list of this. When it comes to the overcompliance, we are not talking here about an individual judgment or an individual regulatory activity of an agency, but we are talking about a whole set of rules that is affecting the country per se. And the most prominent areas that we can identify is health, safety, but also the data privacy and environmental protection rules. I think that is the new book of Anu Breckford that just came out, where you may find lots of evidence for this. You may also, one might also look into what the EU is doing in regulated markets, and indeed in the project that I'm running, we have been looking into energy and telecom and seeing how the EU is trying to steer the process into certain directions. And when I'm saying the EU, it's particularly the European Commission, and the means is in particular technical standards or soft mechanisms, so-called soft mechanisms. So what is the EU doing? I would like to present here at least a bit of the results of a book that will come out this year or It should come out this month. In fact, if the ELGAP keeps its promises, we will see. And what I said in the beginning, and what is, I think, in a way paradigmatic for the whole field, is there is no clear case law. There are no clear cases where we can study what's going on and what kind of role the EU is playing. But we have to go into empirics, and we have to go the difficult path of what the EU is doing. And I highlight here three points that are more or less the result of what we found out in the last years. So the first question is access to the field. Yeah, you have to get access. That means think of a standardizing body, and you want to participate in how technical standards are developed. Then you need to have access. You need to have to talk to the people. And you may, in particular as a PhD researcher, you may have the legitimacy in your back that you find some sympathy and open doors. But then there is another problem that arises. As a researcher, if you get too deeply involved into this area, you become part of it. Yeah? So there's an element of complicity. Yeah? So you have to be, in order to get access, you cannot come not even as a PhD researcher and say, it's a disaster of what you are doing and I want to investigate it. That's certainly not a good start. Yeah. But when you are then in the field, and I can, out of experience, admit that the longer you work together with industry, I am involved with the credit industry to some extent, the more you become closer to the way they are thinking, yeah, and you lose, the risk is to lose your academic distance. Otherwise, without access, you cannot study the field. Think of Lisa Bernstein's famous articles. Yeah. So Lisa Bernstein, she's really, she wrote these wonderful pieces of the diamond and the cotton industry that made her famous. And that was only possible because she had access. The next category where we struggled with was the distinction between public, private, and semi-private actors. So when you look into the mechanisms, let me stay within the standardizing bodies, yeah? So you have public authorities, you have private companies, you have private associations, but when it comes really to link and to understand their role in the rulemaking and in the rule enforcement process, it is hard to identify who is doing what, and here we are in the field of the vanishing public-private divide beyond the nation-state, yeah, and the question of to what extent private parties beyond the nation-states bear a responsibility for what they are doing to the public at large. The most difficult one is what you can find in most of EU legal scholarship on external relations, and you may contradict if I'm wrong, but there is what I call this better rhetoric. Yeah. So the better rhetoric means EU environmental regulation is better than. Yeah. And EU health and safety regulation is better than. And this comparative language is a very difficult one, because there is certainly a bias, but it's also the question, first of all, how do you measure? Yeah, is it so easy just to go into technicalities of environmental law or health and safety and say the higher the standards, the better it is for the people and the world. That is much more complicated, as we all know. But nevertheless, you find it there, which brings me to, and that is really where I will finish, to the difficult question that is always linked to this kind of discourse when it comes to defining the role of the EU. What is the legitimacy of the EU to decide on behalf, or to decide that this and that standard is good for the rest of the world or for the other countries that are in contact with the EU? This is one of the most litigated issues intellectually, the issue of legitimacy in the rule production. There is certainly in the EU a big potential. You may, in the external relations field, you may remember the amendment in the Lisbon Treaty of good governance, good governance in external relations, good governance. And a lot has been written. And if you measure this against the reality, you may have a mixed picture that is exactly also the result of our book, if you go into the details. I think we are approaching a world where we have, in particular after Brexit, that cannot miss. We are approaching a world where we have different competitors globally. Yeah. So we have not only the US and the EU, we have now the UK. And it's not clear whether the UK is joining forces with the US or what kind of role the UK will be playing. We have China, we have Russia, So, and I think it is interesting academically that there will be regulatory models that are competing, and the question is, how do the countries to which these policies are addressed, how will these countries react, and how will the companies react? Don't get it wrong. I am deeply convinced that the American companies operating outside US territory will not understand Kyoto as carte blanche. Yeah? So we must be very cautious because there the empirics come in, what I try to explain. Thank you very much.